So this is Philosophy 201 Ethics. I'm Professor Borrowdale. There are no other philosophy courses required as prerequisites for this course. If you want to add, there's some red slips going around. Put down your name and L number, and make sure to add your phone number, like put it on the back or something, or at the bottom, wherever, just so I'll see it there. And actually, your email address will be useful to me, too. And I'll collect those at the end of class, and I hope to give you some good news on Wednesday. I'm also going to roll through the roll after a couple of minutes because there's going to be people trickling in here. Are there any seats? There's a seat up here. If you want to grab one, there's actually one right here up front, and get kind of thin on the seats. Oh, you can, somebody can take the red chair in the corner if you want. So so the syllabus is in Moodle. If you're not familiar with Moodle, Moodle is the online course system we use here at Lane. It is similar to Blackboard and WebCT, but it is open source, and we like to support the open source. So I was one of the early adopters of Moodle here at the college. I like it. I think it's pretty transparent, easy to use, and I put all my stuff up there. So there will be recordings of course sessions in audio format. I may even be posting the video there today. Mostly I want to have a backup for audio in case something glitched up. I'm going to experiment with the video this term. I might not put everything up there, but I might have some things up there on video. I'm still making those decisions. I have to talk with the tech guys about whether it's going to be feasible this term to get the video up there. Let's see, what else about this course? So this is an introduction to ethics. This is what's called meta-ethics or normative ethics. It's theoretical and applied. Now, we will look at particular cases, look at examples, ethical conundrums and dilemmas, and so we will be looking at how we apply these theories. But it is largely theoretical. If you're interested in more of a kind of a practical ethics, we have a contemporary moral issues class that looks at abortion, euthanasia, doctor-assisted suicide, the role and scope of government, pornography, censorship, gay marriage, doctor-assisted suicide, capital punishment, all those kinds of things, those hot-button issues. But this will be a class in sort of foundational theory. So it sounds kind of dry when you say it like that. But, you know, ethics can also be fun. But if you take this course, you'll have a kind of theoretical underpinnings to approach those issues. And instead of kind of piecemeal saying, okay, well, how I feel about this or something, right? You actually have some principles, and you can apply the principles to a specific case and say, okay, here's my principles, here are the facts of the case, here's my judgment. Instead of just sort of this kind of loosey-goosey thing where people like kind of, you know, go on how they feel, and how they feel in one case might not be how they feel in another case. Maybe you ate something bad in the cafeteria, you might feel different than if you actually had something good. Maybe you're tired. So feelings are a very unreliable guide to ethics and to things that I suppose to all sorts of things. In this course, in philosophy in general, we like to stick to logic, the facts, understanding reality. And so when you come to ethics, there's a big question about what is the ethical reality. And so we'll be looking at some of the major theories, and today we'll actually be looking at all of the sort of basic categories of ethical theory, whether ethics is absolute or relative to the individual or to the culture, whether ethics might be based in the commands of divine being, whether ethics could be based on the greatest good for the greatest number, or it's a matter of individual rights and responsibilities. And then we'll be looking at some things near the end of the course about this idea about whether you should look at particular acts and say, well, is this act right or wrong? Or whether you should be focusing more on the individual and his character and be thinking in terms of the ideal or good person. And we'll look at Aristotle near the end. And Aristotle says, look, once you understand what a good person is and you have a kind of ideal in your mind about what a good person would do, then a good person will automatically do the right thing. So what we need to do is cultivate those virtues of character. which will lead a person to do the right thing at the right time in the particular situation. And Aristotle has this idea that ethics is kind of like a skill. It's not something you can learn in a book. It's not something you can teach without doing in a lot of practice. And you might think about, he compares it to archery. So it's sort of, you know, you can't like read a book on archery and pick up the bow and just start shooting bullseyes, right? You got to practice. And so think about today, analogy I like to use is learning to drive a stick shift. I don't know if any of you have had the pleasure of learning to drive a stick, but you first start going, you stall out, and the car lurches back and forth, you know, and it sounds so easy. Your friend does it with ease, and they're trying to show you how to do it, and they say, just, you know, ease up on the clutch while you press down the accelerator, and it seems really easy, and then you stall out, and you try it, and try it again, and finally, you kind of find that sweet spot, you're like, oh, okay, I think I got it. And then after a while, it's just second nature. And Aristotle thinks about ethics like that. And then we'll also look at Nietzsche, who's kind of he calls himself the world's greatest immoralist. So sometimes philosophers are called moralists or moral philosophers. Well, Nietzsche fancies himself as an immoral philosopher and kind of turns morality on its head. And he says that almost everything that people think is good is actually bad, and everything that people think is bad is actually good. And so the normal idea of, like, you know, respecting other people's rights, and the most important thing is to not hurt anybody and be kind to animals and the environment and have no effect on anything in the world. And Nietzsche says, no, to be a good person means to enforce your will on the world. And it might mean, you know, breaking a few eggs if you're going to make that omelet. And it might mean, stepping on some toes, and stepping on some people. And so he has a sort of idea that of morality as the will to power. So we'll be talking about that as well. A little earlier on, we'll look at a kind of the question about how much of morality it really has to do with other people. And we'll be looking at egoism that says morality is all about looking out for number one. And we'll be looking at Thomas Hobbes and Ayn Rand. We'll also be looking at this sort of idea of the social contract and get into some political philosophy there, because Thomas Hobbes is really the person who came up with the social contract theory. Locke sometimes gets credit for it, but Hobbes, you know, is around not quite, I guess, 100 years before him. And Rousseau, particularly in the poli-sci department here, people love Rousseau because he's kind of a socialist, and he's all about the social contract and how we are all into this together, and, you know, individual rights, you know, have to take the back seat to the common good. And Hobbes has a social contract theory, but it's based on egoism, which is kind of interesting. And he says, look, it's in your enlightened self-interest to get along with your neighbor, and instead of fighting with them, to work together to produce things, to grow crops, to have, like, nice buildings, and to not always be looking over your shoulder and wondering whether somebody's going to hit you over the head and take your money. And so in that way, you might think, well, okay, it seems like at first blush that it would be in my interest to, sort of slink around the shadows and steal and cheat and lie when I can get away with it. But as you think it through, you might think, well, okay, maybe that might be some short-term gain, but what's in my long-term interest? And what's in your long-term interest might be what you get, like say a Dale Carnegie class, right? This sort of idea of winning friends and influencing people. And nobody likes to be around a backstabber and a gossip and a person who breaks their promises all the time and can't be trusted. You want to be around people. And someone who's kind of a jerk and loses their temper all the time and doesn't give a damn about anybody but themselves. And so it may turn out that in a lot of cases, being a sort of a more conventionally good person actually is in your interest. And it's in your interest to behave as a moral person, not, you know, necessarily for the sake of others, but maybe just for your own sake. Okay, so we'll go over those in detail in just a moment. Let's see, just the nuts and bolts of the course. What do you have to do to pass this course? Well, there are two midterms and a final. They are to be taken in the testing lab over in Center 456. Or if you live in Cottage Grove, you can take it out at the Cottage Grove Center. It'll be multiple choice, true or false. What else about the test? You'll have a window of time to take them, about a week. I'll give you at least 5 working days. So you'll have, but about from like say a Monday to a Monday or a Wednesday to a Wednesday. And I usually start the test like right after we finish the material. So we finish here at 3:30, 3:20 on Wednesday afternoon. Test is open at 3:30, so you can go and take it. And then you'll have like till the following Wednesday to complete it. And if you need an extension, you can send me a Moodle message or an email, and that's fine. So, and a word on we have 2 midterms and a final. They're all worth 30%. And then you have a weekly forum posting worth 10%.
Countdown.
Tragedy of the commons. This is the problem with like communistic system. You know, actually, if I wanted to go fully private, I should have like some pens in my. I had some pens in my bag. I took them out when I went traveling, so I get them back in there.
Private property is where it's at. So.
Otherwise, you're at the mercy of the Yelta that came in before you. Leaves the cap off the pens or tries them out. Nobody ever replaces them. And then the forums. So the exams are all worth 30% and the forums are worth 10%. You might think, oh, the forums at 10%, what could that be? I'll just ignore that. Well, that's one letter grade. And so I get students at Duke like consistent B+, A- work. And they end up getting like a C+ in the course, maybe at the end, or maybe a B- when they could have gotten an A. And why? Because they didn't do any of the forum postings. So you know these will really hurt you. It's the difference between say an 87, which is like a B+, and a 77, which is a C+, if you didn't do any of them. Or it could be half a letter grade if you do less. So so make sure you do these. These are due Sunday. By 11:55 p.m., or I should say, before Sunday 11:55 p.m. Yeah.
Is it like one posting, or?
So you only have to write one posting, but you're supposed to read every posting. And I do have test questions, you know, based on the postings there. So it'll be a discussion. I'll have a topic. I'll give you a topic. I'll get those up. This afternoon, and there'll be and you'll get like maybe 5 different questions you could comment on, and then you just have to answer one of those, or you know, address something that you find interesting that's relevant to the topic. It doesn't necessarily have to be one of my prefab questions. Those are just kind of there to get your creative intellectual juices flowing, and so you're just not staring at the blank page thinking ethics. Well, today, basic ethical theories. What do I think? Yeah.
Are you asking for like a paragraph or like?
So I'm looking for, what did I put in the minimum? The way I quantify the minimum's always changed. I'm looking for something that substantially addresses course topics, and I think, let me look at my syllabus real quick to see if I quantified that.
100 words.
100 words? 100 words. If that's what it is, that's what it is. So that's like, you know, 5 sentences or something, yeah.
Is it okay to respond to somebody else's post, or do you have to come up with like an original idea for each account?
No, actually it's encouraged for you to respond to other people's posts. $100 if you... I don't see 100 words on here. Is that in the forums or something? Is it from a previous class? Who said 100 words? I'm looking at my syllabus and I don't see 100 words.
It's on right here in Moodle. I was looking at the week 1 forum.
Oh, so the week 1 forum? Okay, it says 100 words. All right, I'll stick with that then. So 100 words. Okay, so, you know, you can write more. Don't write like 500 words. That's way too much. And, like, people will just skip over your post if it's that long. You know, cut down. You know, it's all today it's all about the Twitter and the Facebook updates, right? 140 characters. Okay, well, you know, you want 100 words, a little more than 140 characters. But you'll be succinct. So now don't go under the 100 words or you're going to get dinged for points or not get credit. So in order to address these without just sort of a meaningless Me Too comment, you got to use at least 100 words. So, you know, between 1, 200, maybe 300 if you have a lot to say around there someplace, but definitely more than 100, and just once a week. So it shouldn't take you, I mean, if you've been keeping up with the reading and coming to class, it shouldn't take you that long to write 100 words on the course topic. Or respond to somebody else's post on that topic. But the most important thing for the post, so it has to address the course topics and be on subject. It has to be at least 100 words, and it has to be posted by the deadline. And that last one is very important. And it's especially important if you're there at like 11:54 and you press the submit button, you get a connection failure, or you know something happens and your post goes in the ether. You don't want to be that guy. So 11:55 is late, no credit. So, because this is 1% of your grade, but it adds up. So, you know, get in there at least early Sunday night, and if you and actually, I mean, you want to pick it like a day you do it every week, so you don't forget. The danger of Sunday night is that if you forget, then it's Monday, and then you'll like send me a message, or you'll just post and hope, and you won't see any credit there. So. And then you'll hate yourself. And you'll think, oh, stupid. Why didn't I post on time? So don't do that. If you have to miss for any reason, I'll have an extra credit form where you can make up one, just one post. So, and it'll just be for that purpose. So you get one, forgot, out of town, sick, whatever. The other ones, you know, because it's kind of such a bare bones requirement, and I'm not grading these except for whether you did it, whether it's, you know, addresses a topic. You know, I'm pretty strict about these deadlines. So post early to avoid missing due to life complications, whatever they may be, tech, girlfriend, you know, whatever it is. You know, stuff happens. I realize that, but so that's all the reason to do it early. Two midterms and a final and testing lab, forums every week before Sunday, 11:55 p.m. And you can post on Monday, right, as soon as I get the topics up. I do choose my own topics because it gives it like a nice threaded structure. If you've taken other Moodle courses where you get to choose your own topic, you'll notice there's like 40 topics and there's like two or three, you know, comments in each one or something like that, and you're click, trying to read them all. It's a pain. So I give you topics and the prompts and so on. And those will be up generally before class on Mondays. Sometimes I get them up Sunday night. Sometimes it won't be until like shortly before class on Mondays. Any questions about course requirements?
When's the first forum?
Oh, the first forum ends this Sunday, 11:55 p.m. Topics will be up, let's say, by 4 o'clock today. So I'll have at least one. I'll get the topics up right after class here. Or say by 4:30, that's when my office hours end. They'll be up then. And then you'll have until Sunday, 11:55 p.m. to post your response. And so that's every week of the 10 weeks. The exams, I'll put the dates in Moodle this evening. But basically, like starting week three, going to week four for the first one, and then week, you know, six or seven, I think, for the second one, and the finals during final exam week. And you'll have until from Monday through Thursday. The final, you'll just get 4 days for that, because the testing lab closes Thursday at 5 during finals week.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Where's those testing labs?
It's center building 456, right at the top of the stone steps. And between right across from the Language, Literature, and Communication, formerly the English Department, which was easier to say. Say LLC, but people think you're talking about Limited Liability Corporation. What else? Oh, so communication with me. So if anyone has left a message on my voicemail, I apologize for getting back to you, but I really hate that orange light when it stares at me. So I listen to my messages when I have to. I've been on vacation. I just got in middle of last week, had a bunch of meetings, and you wouldn't believe how many messages I get. And I have to sit through Shaggy Dog story after Shaggy Dog story, and it's a pretty thankless task. So I'm all about the Moodle messages. Moodle messages live in Moodle. If I'm in Moodle, I'm doing course stuff, I want to see if I got messages, they pop right up there. And if you send me a Moodle message, I'm going to answer right after class here. If you have a message sitting on my phone, my voicemail, who knows when I'll get to it. I hate talking on the phone, and I hate answering the phone. I may answer the phone during my office hours, but the best and quickest response you'll get from me is the Moodle messages. And so I've got a messages block turned on there in Moodle. You just click messages, and you can search for my name, Borrowdale, and it'll pop right up there, and then you can add me as a contact. And if you need any help with Moodle, just read the FAQ or FAQ on the Moodle Help page, and I got a link to Moodle Help in Moodle. Or go over to the the shed, student help desk. They still call it the shed? I don't know. They keep on changing names for things, right? It used to be Students First, now it's Enrollment Services. But anyway, they have the student help desk, and I've got information on the syllabus on that as well, and they can help you out. You learn to use Moodle. But Moodle messages first, and then I answer my emails, and the phone. Phone comes dead last, and of course you always get me in my office, and my office hours will be in the syllabus too. So, let's see, other things about the course. The text, this is an old edition of the text. The new one's kind of shrunk up and small. I apologize for the price. It's a limited print run. I'm trying to get picked up by the big boys. I know what they would charge, though, so it's a small press and small print run, so the fewer you print, the more it costs. So I know students are, trying to get by. So if you can get, if you can hunt down the fifth edition and you want to get a copy of, Atlas Shrugged, and I think there's a couple of other things I stuck in there and fixed some typos, you can probably get by with, the fifth edition and a used copy of Atlas Shrugged. But they're in the bookstore there. I think they're $40 or something like that. I suppose it's better than a calculus book or I'm taking a photo class myself, and I saw used the book is $100. So there's that. That's the only textbook required for the course. There'll be some stuff on the exam which we may not talk about in here, but which is in the book and vice versa. So it's important to both read and come to class. And ideally reading before you come to class. So this week we'll be talking about chapter 1 and chapter 2. And actually we're going to be covering chapter 1 today. And then next week is going to be today chapter 1 and Wednesday chapter 2. They're pretty short chapters. Chapter 1 is really short. It's just an introduction, basic overview. But it's a lot of very important, densely packed information which you're going to need to understand to understand the rest of the book. So very short, but also very, very important. And the stuff we do at the beginning, the sort of fundamental issues, is really important to get. Because if you don't get them at the beginning, they're going to trip you up later on. So we'll be talking about basic ethical theories today, and then on Wednesday, moral relativism.
I'm interested in learning how our religion and upbringing has to do with the way we believe in our ethics.
They're a very interesting and important issue. There was that comment that Miss America made about gay marriage that caused such a firestorm of controversy. And she said, no offense to anybody out there, it's just the way I was raised. And my first thought, well, when people will say this, they'll say, it was just the way I was raised. I think, well, if you're raised by the Klan, would you have to be out there burning cross? I mean, you're an adult right now. Do you still ask your mom's permission to stay out late? So it always seems strange to me that people don't think critically about the values in which they're raised, but they just sort of hold on to them no matter what they are. And it seems to me that a big thing about education is to question the beliefs you're raised with, and then either stick with them or get rid of them, depending on whether they seem true to you upon critical analysis, rational scrutiny, seeing whether they make sense to you, instead of just sort of going along with them because that's the way you're raised.
So let's talk about basic ethical theories.
So the main distinction, so we're getting into the meat of ethics now. So the main distinction, the difference between ethics, the basic kinds of ethical theories. Doesn't work at all. It doesn't really work like that.
Let's see if I can get another pen here. Sometimes people hide them here. Now, let me do what we got here. Let me try them out. Let's see if I got one here. I like traveling light. Put it back in my satchel. So we'll make do with this. This is my new style. Well, maybe I'll just end up talking then. So there's a chart and text. And what page is it on?
Page two?
Really? The chart? Basic ethical theories?
Page 2.
Okay. So you have realism and anti-realism. So realism says that there actually is such a thing as morality, i.e., morality is real. So, and the contrary theory, moral skepticism, also known as moral nihilism, the Latin word nihil means nothing. So nihilism is belief in nothing. So it's belief that there really is no such thing as morality. Is that going to be tough for you to take notes? Is there a way you can prop that up on something? How about we try to clean up spots or something? Or see if you can, tie up there. See if you can, maybe stuff in the bottom here. Did I stop it? Did I press the stop button?
No.
Okay, good. See if that's going to work. Awesome. Makeshift stand. So realism says there really is such a thing as morality, and then anti-realism or skepticism or nihilism says no, there ain't no such animal. That people have moral beliefs or they have moral feelings maybe, or they engage in what we call moral behavior. But there's nothing to it. And think about it similar to a kind of a moral atheist, right? So an atheist says there is no God. Now, an atheist recognizes that people have religious beliefs, people engage in religious behavior, people have religious feelings, right? But he would say, but really, there is no God, and that there's some other explanation for these things. So they'll say, well, it's a projection of a father figure. It's based on some weird thing our brain does. It's schizophrenia. It's there are all sorts of explanations for religion. One theory is that early in human evolution, you had more people that have these sort of dreams and visions, and maybe that. And today we get there's a certain percentage of the population that's more likely to see these sort of dreams and visions. And neuroscientists say there's something different from their brains than other people's brains. And so these people get recognized as prophets and as religious leaders. Then their teachings get inculcated into a culture, and then they get passed on from generation to generation.
So all that is consistent with there being no God, right? It's the religion is seen as a cultural phenomena, a projection of the father figure, or you know, the opiate of the masses, Karl Marx, right? So all sorts of explanations for religious activity, which has nothing to do with there actually being God. So in the same way, in morality, you have moral skeptics who will say, well, yes, you know, people say certain things are right and wrong, but what does that really mean? It's just a human adaptation, or it's a cultural sort of institutionalized form of you know, I mean, there's a bunch of different ideas about where morality comes from, if there's no such thing as morality. But, you know, one might be it's an evolutionary adaptation that allows human beings to work together in groups and serves their survival. Some people think that you know, human beings are social animals, and so as social animals, we have certain natural moral feelings. We have feelings of sympathy for people when they're harmed. We have an attraction to babies, and we want to take care of babies. Like, there was this kitten that was abandoned by its mother, and my wife heard it, like, mewing outside. Right, just mewing, and she's like, oh, is this poor little kitten outside, it's abandoned by its mother. And, you know, looking around for the kitten, and sends me out there, right? And pretty soon, you know, we're adopting the kitten, right? So she's like nursing the kitten with a little bottle. Why, you know, why is that? Is, you know, it seems like the kind of Kantian idea that she had a moral obligation to take care of those less fortunate. No, it's just, you know, we have these moral feelings, and this is why when people see a baby, they're like, oh, the cute little baby. This is why, you know, your aunt sends you those cute little animal pictures right on the email that maybe you'd rather not see. So this is, it's these natural human feelings that we have. And it's, you know, the same reason why, like, if you're, like, at a sporting event and you're a guy and you see, the ball is thrown and it hits one of the players right in the crotch and he, like, doubles over. You can go, ooh, like that. And you're, like, your legs kind of go together and you, like, you feel kind of squeamish, right? Or if, like, you're at a, or if you, like, you're watching videos on YouTube, right, and see that skater dude who's, like, super, super skinny with, like, the bone-thin arms, and he, like, has a wreck and tries to catch himself, and the skinny little arm snaps like a twig, like, ugh, right? And so it's the same way. It's like if you see acts of human brutality and degradation, it makes you feel kind of yucky, because you're, in the back of your mind, you're thinking, well, what if that happened to me? You know, and your mind plays this association game between the feelings of other people and yourself. And actually, that they've done studies in neuroscience that says that you have these mirror neurons that sort of is how we socialize, and they help us to interact with other people, where you can read people's expression, you get feedback, and you get this sort of back and forth that goes on between people and allows you to get along. So, you know, different explanations for why people behave morally, and the moral nihilist or skeptic or anti-realist will say, you can explain it through science or through culture or maybe politics with this sort of Marxist idea. But really, there is nothing to morality. That morality is a form of culturally inculcated or natural behaviors. That are partly genetic, partly acquired by our culture, and that's all there is to it. And now, on the other hand, the realists will say, well, no, there is something to morality. Morality is real. There is such a thing as goodness, as justice, as right and wrong. And no matter what culture you're grown up in, and no matter what your personal beliefs may be, certain things are right and wrong. Torturing babies for fun is wrong. And it doesn't matter whether you were raised in a culture where torturing babies was acceptable, or it doesn't matter whether you personally believe that torturing babies for fun is okay. Torturing babies for fun is wrong. And it's really hard, you know, to make an argument to the contrary. And there's certain things about, like, you know, hitting an old lady over the head with a brick and stealing her purse for, you know, $23 in change and some free dent. Or, you know, going around, like, you know, raping and murdering women and throwing their bodies in the river, right? The people like to like say, oh well, you know, morality is relative, and what's right for you might not be right for me. And you say, well, what about the Green River Killer? That was just like his personal beliefs. And you go, oh wait a minute, that's not what I meant, right? Or what about Hitler? Oh well, Hitler was a bad guy. Oh really? I thought you said morality was culturally relative. The Nazis were a particular culture at a particular time. The majority liked the Nazis, and so it seems like that this idea of belief in moral absolutism, although perhaps drummed out of you in your government education, in favor of some form of relativism or subjectivism, really it seems like there is a sort of plausibility that certain things, particularly certain awful things, are seem to be wrong absolutely, and certain other things, like helping a little old lady across the street, or rescuing a baby laying in the middle of the street, right? Those sorts of things seem to be morally correct. So realism says there is such thing as morality. Anti-realism says no such thing as morality. And then underneath the realist view, you have the question about whether morality is absolute or relative. And that's a separate distinction. So if you're a moral nihilist, you don't ask whether morality is absolute or relative, because you say, well, what morality, right? There isn't a such thing as morality. But once you say, okay, there really is something called morality, certain things are right, certain things are wrong, then the question comes, well, wrong for everybody? Are things right or wrong for every human being on the planet? Or does it depend on what culture you are, that you're a part of? Or does it depend on, your conscience? And so the absolutist will say, no, morality is universal. Certain things are right and wrong for everyone. And then the relativist will say, it doesn't make any sense to have things right and wrong for everyone. They're only right and wrong for fill in the blank. And there's two kinds of relativists. So you can be a cultural relativist. There the unit of comparison is the culture. And so for a cultural relativist, what makes something right or wrong is whether the majority of the society believe in or practice it or not. So say this culture that Montaigne talks about of cannibals. If you have a culture that practices the eating of human flesh, and if the majority agrees that he eating human flesh, yum, right? Then it's okay. It's morally okay. If the majority disapproves of it, like say in France or something, then it's not morally okay. And if you're like a member of the cannibal culture and you say eating human flesh is wrong, then you're wrong. You're a bad person. And if you're in France and you're cooking up one of your relatives in the stove, you're a bad person, right? You're doing something wrong. Why? Because, not because of some absolute right or wrong, but because the majority of Frenchmen say that snails, yum, 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 human flesh, you're a reprehensible person if you're eating that. Let's see. And so you can be an absolutist or a relativist, and then you can be either a cultural relativist that says morality is relative to culture, or you can be an individual relativist, also known as a subjectivist. And the individual relativist is sort of subscribes to the Jiminy Cricket school of morality. You let your conscience be your guide. And so the individual relativist would say that each person is a moral island unto themselves, and they decide what's right or wrong for them. Or for him or her, to be grammatically correct. So if you're, it is the kind of morality you get like in sitcoms, right? You see there's some moral dilemma, and one character comes to another and says, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do. And the other person says, oh, just follow your heart, right? Do what you think is right. Only you can decide what you should do in this situation. So instead of bringing up Kant or Aristotle or bringing up like principles or something, there's this idea that each person cannot each person makes their own moral decisions, and they that moral judgments come from within, and that each person is their own moral lawgiver and decides what's right or wrong for that person. And what might be wrong, right for one person might not be right for another person, and so on. And so in that case, if you're an individual relativist, even if the whole culture is against you, you're still not wrong. Because according to individual relativism or subjectivism, it's not just the individual. It's not the majority doesn't decide what's right or wrong. If you're a cultural relativist, the majority decides what's right or wrong, and whatever the majority believes, that's what's right or wrong. Individual relativism, you can be a rebel, you can believe different from the majority, and you can still be right. Why? Because it's what you believe, and it's what you've chosen as your moral code. And the only way you can do something wrong as an individual relativist is if you go against your own moral code, whatever it happens to be. So basically, the only sin, according to subjectivism, is hypocrisy. You have, let's suppose you're a vegetarian, right? And so you're a vegetarian, and in the moment of weakness, driving by the Burger King, you smell that stuff that they pump up the smokestack to try to get customers, and you drive in there, and you eat like a double Whopper with cheese, you know, and like, oh, you know, my principles are, I am against factory farming, I'm against the cruelty that goes along with it, and you feel really bad and rotten. But then if somebody else is eating meat, you're like, well, he has a different moral code than I do, and so I'm not going to judge him. But I think I've done something wrong because I did something I didn't believe was right. And so that's the cultural relativism and subjectivism. And then on the other side, you have absolutism. And absolutism is what we'll be spending most of our time with. And so there are several different absolutist theories. There's divine command theory, which says, actually, get these in order. Divine command theory says that morality is based on the commands of a divine being. You have egoism, which says that morality is a matter of self-interest. And then you have utilitarianism and deontology. They're sort of the big gorillas in the room. They're the two of the main ethical theories. Utilitarianism says that morality is a matter of the greatest happiness or the greatest good for the greatest number. And then deontology, which is Immanuel Kant's view, says that morality is a matter of absolute rights and responsibilities of individuals. And this goes back to, like, if you've ever seen a Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, there's this whole bit about whether the good of the many is outweighed by the good of the few or the one. And there's a kind of a character arc that goes on there where at the beginning it's like, well, you know, it's the good of the many is the most important thing. And at the end it turns that there's this view that, well, that maybe that's not true. Maybe the good of the individual trumps the good of the many, that individual rights are really important. And so you go from this kind of utilitarian view at the beginning, which is sort of comes out of Spock, and Spock finally embraces a more kind of deontological or Kantian view at the end. Good philosophy in Star Trek. There's Aristotle and Nietzsche, who's sort of his own his own guy. Aristotle, again, is about the virtue ethics, that ethics is a skill. And ethics for Aristotle is the art of living well, and it's all about personal success. And so Aristotle thinks that there's no real difference between being a good person in the natural sense and in the moral sense. So to have a good life means both to, like, you know, be happy and have health, wealth, and prosperity, and also to be an asset to the community. And Aristotle sees those things as intersecting, and he thinks that a person who's virtuous as an individual will have a good life and also be create a great community when combined with other virtuous individuals. It's not like Kant, where Kant says, well, there's what you desire to do, and there's what your duty is, and they're always at opposite ends of the spectrum. Aristotle thinks that virtue and what's in your interest are the same thing. It's in your interest. It's always in your interest to be virtuous. Those are the basic theories. Nietzsche, again, the will to power, and Nietzsche essentially says that morality is a matter of asserting your will in the world, and you know, making your mark and growing in power and influence and not letting anything get in your way and actualizing yourself as an individual. So similar to Aristotle, but maybe with an edge. I like to think about Nietzsche as sort of Aristotle with an edge. And some of the Aristotelian virtues Nietzsche's kind of weak on or kind of plays around with a little bit. So what might be virtuous in Aristotelian point of view might turn out to be a vice in Nietzsche in some cases, like generosity. I suppose Nietzsche actually says this, that to be a generous person is sort of, if you're going to give, you give out of the feeling of abundance and power, and because you can. You don't give because you feel sorry for people. I think Aristotle would probably agree with that. So I've kind of babbled a lot today. I gave you guys your 2 minutes of fame on my video recorder. But I think on Wednesday, we're going to start with you. And it's all going to be about moral relativism. And so this was kind of uncharacteristic today for me to do a lot of talking. So I'd like to read chapter 1 and chapter 2. And I want to hear from you about moral relativism and what you think. And so make sure to read chapter 1 and 2 by Wednesday, and I'll see you then. And don't forget to log in the Moodle, just so I know you're sticking with the class.